From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross.
Would you be interested in a device that links up to your smartphone and tells you, even before it's happening, whether you're having a panic attack or an actual heart attack?
In the new HBO series Silicon Valley, everybody's pitching apps and looking for the next big thing. Today, Mike Judge talks about creating the show and about working in Silicon Valley in the 80s, an experience that gave him material for the new series and for the movie Office Space, which he wrote and directed.
Yeah, you apparently didn't put one of the new cover sheets on your TPS reports.
Judge also created Beavis and Butthead and King of the Hill. Later, Maureen Corrigan reviews two of the most powerful books she's read this year, and Ken Tucker weighs in on The Both, the collaboration between Amy Mann and Ted Leo. That's coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross, who's off today.
Hello! Woo! I got 7 words for you. I love Ghoulie Bibs integrated multi-platform functionality! Yeah!
What happens when young computer geeks who become millionaires live among thousands more who hope to is the subject of the new HBO series Silicon Valley, created by our guest, Mike Judge. Farhad Manju of the New York Times wrote that Silicon Valley finds comedy in the humdrum annoyances of life on a peninsula overflowing with money, ambition, and very little style. Mike Judge created and did some of the voices for the animated series Beavis and Butthead and King of the Hill, and he wrote and directed the movies Office Space, Idiocracy, and Extract. I spoke to Judge last week, and we began with the scene from the first episode of Silicon Valley. A young programmer, played by Thomas Middleditch, has come up with a revolutionary program that he's been offered $10 million for, and his angst over whether to take the money or develop his own company leads to a panic attack and a visit to a Silicon Valley doctor, played here by Andy Daly.
So, you will survive. It's just a garden variety panic attack. Welcome to Silicon Valley. We see people like you all the time.
Really?
Yes.
Let's just have to make this decision by tomorrow.
Yeah. You know, a while back, we had a guy in here in almost the exact same situation. Take the money or keep the company.
What happened?
Well, a couple months later, he was brought into the ER with a self-inflicted gunshot wound. I guess he really regretted not taking that money.
He shot himself because he turned down the money?
Yeah. Or no, he took the money. Or no. No, he did not. You know what? I don't remember. But whatever it was, he regretted it so much that he ended up shooting himself, and now he's blind.
He's blind?
Yeah, just FYI, if you're ever going to shoot yourself, don't hold the gun up to your temple, okay? Because that just basically took out both of his optic nerves and then, you know, half of his face. Then his wife left him because, you know, yikes.
Right.
You know, he may have been a genius programmer, but not so much with human anatomy. Or decision-making, for that matter. Now he's got to live with all that, and whatever terrible decision he made about the money.
And what do I do if I feel another panic attack coming on?
Would you be interested in a device that links up to your smartphone, and it keeps track of your vitals, and it tells you, even before it's happening, whether you're having a panic attack or an actual heart attack?
Yeah, that sounds great.
You would, right? Yeah. Okay, that's great news, because it's still in prototype phase right now, but my startup partners and I are looking for investors, like today. So will you please let me know? I'm going to give you my number.
And that is from the series Silicon Valley, created by our guest, Mike Judge. Mike Judge, welcome back to Fresh Air. Everybody's got an app. Everybody's got an angle. You want to just say a little bit about what inspired that scene?
In doing this, we've actually had extras on the set pitching their apps to actors. even before people knew I was doing this, I've had people pitch me apps just because, you know, they think I'm richer than I am or something. And that just came out of, I just figured we had to have something in there where as soon as people smell money around the guy, they just start pitching him ideas. And that's kind of a running thing throughout the series, actually.
You know, there are shows about occupations, you know, cops and detectives and lawyers and even Hollywood agents. What's the appeal of a show about the tech world?
Well, the tech world is, it's become really interesting to me, especially in recent years, just watching these personality types, the kind of people I knew in college and in my brief engineering career, just knowing those types and seeing them suddenly have billions and billions of dollars is just, there's something funny about it to me.
You know, maybe you could describe a moment. It's really at the very beginning of the first episode when, you know, a company has been acquired by Google for $200 million. And they have Kid Rock there, because why not if you're throwing a party at that level? And tell us about the interaction with the engineers.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's back before the first dot-com bubble burst. I actually went to it was a party for a website launch that had a lot of money behind it. And I just went because Run DMC was playing. I was just kind of shocked at how you know, here's Run DMC, this legendary, great hip-hop group, and just the way the audience was just kind of talking amongst themselves, and I don't know, it was just kind of a funny scene. So that's that, and also I have a few rock star friends, and I happen to know that they play parties like this occasionally. They kind of look at it as a paid rehearsal. So I just thought that would be a funny way to open it. And then there's the Ghoulie Bib guy who
that's the company that gets bought by Google, right? Yeah.
Yeah, Javed, and yeah, Ghoulie Bib is acquired by Google. They're throwing this big party, and he gets up there and tries to do a Steve Ballmer kind of thing, which is already, Steve Ballmer was probably trying to do somebody that really is good on stage. But that's what's kind of funny, is seeing these people that they have so much money that no one's going to tell them, hey, you shouldn't get a microphone and be on stage like that.
Tell us a little about your work as an engineer. You worked for a company called Parallax, is that right? It sounds like something you'd make up.
No, that was the second company I worked for. Uh-huh. All the companies I worked, well, the first two definitely sound like made up names. The first company was called Support Systems Associates Incorporated. It's got such a ring to it. But the second one was called Parallax Graphics. They made these hardware interface cards for the early high resolution screens, which weren't being sold to the public. It was for very niche, kind of like, I think police departments were buying them for fingerprint technology and the military, stuff like that. So these were things that cost, like, I don't know, around $5,000. I remember they cost the same amount as a Hyundai did at the time.
And were there ways that you and the guys that you worked with, I assume there were guys, ways that they kind of, I don't know, interacted and what they did with their social time that made its way into Silicon Valley?
Yeah, I mean, I never socialized with these guys or much of anybody back then. What was different then is that the barrier to entry to starting your own company was higher. It would take more money to do that. I think it's easier to do now. If I'd been born 25 years later, I might maybe be doing a startup because, you know, just if you have five people who program, you can just start doing it. I mean, everyone owns computers and phones. Back then, hardly anybody even owned a PC, you know, so it was kind of a different world as far as trying to start your own company, but it was very, very much the same personality types. But there's not a specific thing that I can think of. That job probably inspired Office Space a little more. I mean, my first week there was I was a test engineer, and so we were, I won't bore everyone with what exactly we were doing, but I needed a set of schematics from the guy who sat at the station next to me. And I said, okay, can I look at the, I need to use the, can I borrow the RT schematics? And he just goes, nope. And I thought he was joking. I just kind of laughed. And he goes, nope, I'm serious. Nope. Everyone keeps taking them and not bringing them back. I'm not loaning them out. And it was just this, it just kind of made me miserable. Just thought, okay, so this is the guy I'm going to be sitting next to for 12 hours a day.
Silicon Valley has probably changed a lot since you were there. It was earlier in your career. It's bigger now, and you know, it's different in a lot of ways. What did you do to kind of update your grasp of it? Did you visit? I mean, how did you research that world?
Oh, yeah, I spent a lot of time up there. And I mean, aside from living back there in the late 80s, my ex-wife worked in the tech world and is from Palo Alto, so I know the area that well. I feel like it has, in some ways it's changed, but in a lot of ways it's not. But to answer your question, yeah, spent a lot of time up there. I actually went up several times, visited startups. One of my best friends from high school, his nephew works as a programmer at Google, so had an inside track to Google and took a tour and all that stuff. Just lots of just talking to people, going to incubators, and just getting a sense of, you know, just finding stories anywhere we could.
Our guest is Mike Judge. His new series, Silicon Valley, airs Sunday nights at 10 on HBO. We'll continue our conversation after a quick break. This is Fresh Air. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air, and we're speaking with Mike Judge, who created the series Beavis and Butthead and King of the Hill. We're talking about his latest project, the HBO series Silicon Valley, which follows the lives of young computer geeks hoping to come up with the next game-changing program. The guys are living in a house that's run by this guy, Ehrlich. You want to explain what the relationship is?
Yeah, so Ehrlich, I figure, you know, he sold his company Aviato, as he pronounces it, for a few million, I don't know, three or four. But when you buy a house in Palo Alto, that doesn't leave you with much, you know, after taxes and everything. I figure he probably still needs to make money. So he sold that, and he has this hacker hostel where he lets you live there for free and kind of use the resources, the other people there sort of help each other out in exchange for 10% of the of whatever company you're incubating there. Which is actually a really bad deal for Richard Hendricks, Thomas Middleditch's character. But I think he's kind of, you know, people move to Palo Alto, they're a little vulnerable. And we kind of combined, there are hacker hostels and there's also incubators. So we kind of combined them into this incubator where you live there.
This is something you actually see there, where somebody who has some technical talent goes, gets a free room and board and Wi-Fi. And then if he makes it big, splits it with the guy who's paying his bills?
Yeah, the guy gets a percentage, yeah.
There's a wonderful scene where, I mean, you have these different personality types, these techies living in this house it's the leader, Ehrlich, calls an incubator. And to celebrate the money they're going to get for Richard's success, he brings in a stripper. You want to give us a sense of what happens, where that comes from?
Yeah, I mean, that was... the idea with that, and I don't know, maybe that was there's been so much scrutiny on this show. It's weird. I didn't expect this kind of attention, and people are going, "Oh, the only female," and it's not the only female in the series, but the idea there was just to kind of show that these guys aren't like the guys in Entourage or the Hollywood guys. They actually, you bring a stripper, and they just all get shy and want to leave the room. You know, that's what that scene was to show. And she's a girl trying to make money doing this, and here she is, you know, that's why she says, God, I hate Palo Alto. She probably gets called to stuff like this all the time. My first engineering job, a woman working there, it was somebody's birthday, and brought in a stripper for this office birthday party, and both me and my boss left the room. It's just like, I don't, you know, this is weird. It's not, you know, it's, this, these are people we work with, and yuck. So I don't know. That was that was the point of that.
I thought we'd play another clip here. This is from episode 3, and it's a TV advertisement for one of the big software companies in the series called Hooli. Well, it kind of explains itself. Let's listen.
The greatness of human accomplishment has always been measured by size. The bigger, the better. Until now. Nanotech. Smart cars. Small is the new big. In the coming months, Hooli will deliver Nucleus, the most sophisticated compression software platform the world has ever seen. Because if we can make your audio and video files smaller, we can make cancer smaller. And hunger. And AIDS.
Well, so do people in Silicon Valley really believe that what they do is going to make the world better, or is that just, you know, some trope they say?
Well, I mean, I suppose some of the stuff they're doing is making the world a better place. It's just what's interesting to me is it always seems to be this obligatory thing that they have to throw in there. And that's why we made fun of it in the series. I mean, there some people are making the world a better place, some maybe aren't, but it's just funny that most of it's just capitalism. They're trying to make their company as big and profitable as possible, which is fine, but it's always shrouded in this "we're making the world a better place" stuff, which is just, and sometimes maybe they are, but you know, I mean, like a company trying to put internet in all these third world African countries, and they're like, maybe they are making the world a better place for these places. They're also making a ton of money doing it. They don't talk about that as much. Which is fine. It's just I just look at it as just, it's just kind of funny. And when we got greenlit to series, I took all the writers. We went to an incubator, and they bring out their first company, and it's a company, and it's five guys, and it's one East Indian and one Asian, just like our ratio we have in the pilot. And then they pitch their app, and then the end of it, the guy just kind of throws in, like, he goes, you know, and making the world a better place. oh, yeah, I almost forgot. Yeah,
part of the formula, right.
Yeah, and so I don't know, I just think that's kind of funny. It's almost like a religion, like that, you know, you have to say amen at the end of something. Oh, yeah, and we're making the world a better place. Yeah.
There are two fascinating characters in the series here that are heads of big companies that are kind of, you know, giants of the software business, and they're different people. You want to just talk a little bit about those two characters?
Yeah, I mean, to me, Peter Gregory and Gavin Belson just sort of represent two of the different kind of billionaires that I've seen, and I've met a few tech, either billionaires or multi-billionaires or close to billionaires, and it's just sort of... there's the type that's more the introverted genius programmer type, and then the type that's more sort of alpha male aggressive type. And neither of them are based on any one particular person, although it's interesting to watch who people assume that they were based on. And sometimes they're people I've never heard of. well, especially the Gavin one, because I tended to not, I don't know the VC world as much, you know, venture capital, those kind of
people. He's the alpha type, yeah.
Yeah, he's the alpha type, and Peter Gregory's the more introverted kind of Asperger-y type, I guess.
Right. Peter Gregory, this one of these guys who, I guess, as you say, is more the more introverted programmer type, is just a fascinating guy, and it's played beautifully by Christopher Evan Welch, who unfortunately died after you taped these episodes, right?
Yeah. Yeah, in fact, it was kind of during the taping of the, I guess, the sixth or seventh one. There was some overlap, but yeah. And the way he played that to me, it's sad on many levels. He was a wonderful guy, had a family. I mean, there's the personal tragedy side of it, which is awful, but I mean, him doing that character, we've talked about this, even, you know, if he were alive, I'd be saying the same thing. It was really like kind of a breakout performance. It was just, it's hard to describe, but it just reminds me of a lot of different people I've known in this world. And it was just so real, and it's not how he is. I mean, he's channeling something there that's just, was just really great. And it was so fun to write for too. I mean, you know, it was a lot of great stuff we could have done with that. So he was really, really just one of those actors. Just, I just can't stop watching, you know?
Yeah, well, he plays this guy who has this weird kind of inscrutable charisma. And, let's listen to one. There's a scene where the central character, Richard, this young programmer who's happened upon this terrific idea, has come to him, and Peter Gregory is ready to help him out. And they have a meeting, and Gregory makes some demands. Should we listen to that one? That's an interesting
sure.
scene.
Yeah, okay, yeah, good. Yeah, I like that one.
Well, we're just really excited to get going, Mr. Gregory.
Yes. Who's we?
Myself.
Him.
The guys back at the house.
Guys? What guys? Who is this?
Ehrlich Bachman. I'm an entrepreneur, much like yourself. Richard actually developed Pied Piper while residing in my incubator, so as per our agreement, I own 10% of the company.
I'm paying you $200,000 for 5%, yet you're giving this man twice that in exchange for a futon and some sandwiches?
Actually, sir, my tenants provide their own food. And
what other percentages have you apportioned? Can I see your cap table, investment deck, business plan, or any other relevant paperwork you may have prepared?
I just was under the impression that we would just be coming by and saying hi, you know, to pick up the check. And I just didn't know that any of that stuff was due yet.
Due? This is not college, Richard. I'm not going to be giving you a course syllabus. You turned down $10 million to keep Pied Piper. What did you give up that money for? What is this company? What did I buy?
about the algorithm, which...
No! The algorithm is the product of the company. I know that. What I'm asking about is the company itself. Who is it? What do they do? Are they essential? Or do you just throw a percentage at them like you did with this? This all must be worked out now.
When you said you'd guide us through some of the stuff, I thought that this was the stuff you'd be guiding us through.
I cannot guide you until you give me something to guide. This is going very poorly.
And that's the late Christopher Evan Welch, Thomas Middleditch, and T.J. Miller in the new HBO series Silicon Valley, created by our guest Mike Judge. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
The Neubauer Family Foundation supports WHYY's Fresh Air and its commitment to sharing ideas and encouraging meaningful conversation. Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from eSurance, insurance for the modern world. With the video appraisal tool, customers can video chat with a claims adjuster in real time. eSurance.com. From Rhodes Scholar, with educational travel adventures to 150 countries, including Cuba, at roadscholar.org. And from Anchor Bay Entertainment, with Philomena, directed by Stephen Frears and starring Steve Coogan and Judi Dench, on Blu-ray and DVD. This is NPR.
Coming up, more with Mike Judge about his 1999 film Office Space, a cult favorite about disgruntled workers at a software company called Inatech. Also, Maureen Corrigan reviews two graphic novels set in New York City, and Ken Tucker reviews the new album The Both, a collaboration of singer-songwriters Amy Mann and Ted Leo. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross, who's off today. We're speaking with Mike Judge, who created and did many of the voices for the series Beavis and Butthead and King of the Hill, and has written and directed three films. Judge created the new HBO series Silicon Valley, which airs Sunday nights at 10. Well, Mike Judge, the last time you were on Fresh Air, I mean, Terry talked to you about Beavis and Butthead and King of the Hill, and you did some great characters there, such as Hank and Boomhauer. One thing that you didn't talk about that I want to talk about is the film Office Space, 1999, which in my family, people regularly quote lines from to one another. It wasn't a huge box office hit, but people love it on DVD. It's about life in a workplace, right?
It's kind of, I worked in cubicles, and it started out, it was the very first thing I ever animated that I finished with sound and everything was a two-minute short called Office Space, and it was in 1990. So it was before Dilbert. I just have to say that because I don't want people to think I stole from Dilbert.
Right. You can find that short on YouTube, and it you will recognize Unfortunately, those, though, those characters.
One thing I got to say about the YouTube one, and I, as a user of YouTube, what bugs me is I made that short in my house with, I timed every syllable with a stopwatch. I shot everything one frame at a time, meticulously got the lip sync really perfect, and it's on YouTube like a second out of sync. So for all the world to see after all my work on that. But yeah, you know, check it out and maybe imagine that it's in sync.
I wanted to listen to a scene from Office Space. And in this, we hear Peter Gibbons, who's the main character, played by Ron Livingston. I should say central character. It's kind of an ensemble cast. Peter Gibbons, who's played by Ron Livingston, works at this company called Inatech, hates his job. It seems pointless. He has too many bosses who don't seem to really have much to contribute but are always around. And the scene we're going to hear, he's already heard from several people that there are these monthly reports he has to turn in. I think they're called TPS reports. And now they're supposed to have cover sheets, but he forgot the first time to put on the cover sheet. And in the scene, we're going to hear his boss, Bill Lumberg, who is played by Gary Cole, comes by his cubicle to tell him about what else, the sheets. Let's listen.
Hello, Peter. What's happening?
We have sort of a problem here.
Yeah, you apparently didn't put one of the new cover sheets on your TPS reports.
Oh, yeah. I'm sorry about that. I forgot.
Yeah. You see, we're putting the cover sheets on all TPS reports now before they go out.
Did you see the memo about this?
Yeah. Yeah, I have the memo right here. I just forgot. But it's not shipping out till tomorrow, so there's no problem.
Yeah. If you could just go ahead and make sure you do that from now on, that would be great. And I'll go ahead and make sure you get another copy of that memo. Okay?
Yeah, no, I have
Peter.
The memo. I've got it. It's right.
Hello, Phil. What's happening?
And that is Gary Cole and Ron Livingston from the movie Office Space, written and directed by our guest, Mike Judge. That's the kind of scene that's funnier the third time than the first, and I still love it. When I played it here, one of our producers, John Meyer, said, I love that scene. It's hard to imagine a scene like that in a movie trailer, which made me think this must not have been the easiest sell to the network.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think if I hadn't done animated shorts and if I hadn't had two hit TV shows back-to-back, that movie never would have happened. I mean, it was something where I just kind of wanted them to trust me. And then when it didn't do well at the box office right away, it was like, okay, I guess we shouldn't trust you. But then, I mean, now it's made them lots of money. It's been a profitable movie. But yeah, that was, and you're right. It's hard to, I mean, to be fair to them, like I think, you know, some people say, oh, well, Fox didn't promote it well, but that was a hard one to cut a trailer from, especially I think you could now, but, yeah, it's a weird movie. I don't know. yeah, a scene like that, I don't know if you don't generally see in a world. Yeah.
Right.
If we could just go ahead.
Right. Well, you know, the persona of the boss there, you know, played by Gary Cole Lumberg, that whole like, you know, yeah, what's happening? If you could just take that. This was somebody you knew or where did that come from?
It wasn't any specific person. It kind of came a few different ways. When I was, I worked at Whataburger, which is a Texas, New Mexico chain of a burger place. And I worked at Jack in the Box. This was when I was young. And me and my brother and a roommate of mine, I was just talking about how it's funny the way a boss will say, when it's the worst job, like the worst thing ever at both those jobs is to change the fryers. And the way someone will say, yeah, Mike, why don't you go ahead and change the fryers? And it's to say go ahead, and it's as if you were just chomping at the bit to go do it, and I'm just going to cut you loose and go ahead. I mean, it just now it's so commonplace. I think, but that type of boss, I think in the 50s, a boss would say, hey, Milton, move your desk. Thanks. And then I don't know if it's the baby boom generation or everyone has to be cool. Suddenly it turned over like in the 70s and 80s, it turned into like, yeah, if I could get you to just go ahead and move your desk. And it's just this kind of, oh, I'm casual. I'm cool. I'm not your 50s boss. And I would just prefer someone just coming up and telling you what to do. I would respect more. But I guess to answer your question, though, that kind of evolved out of that. And then also just even, you know, over the years, like just noticing the yeah that means no. Like if you say, right. Oh, can I have Friday off? Yeah.
You know, I wonder if when you were, you know, pitching this to studios or talking to them about it, one of the issues might have been that people in studios, a lot of them really haven't had the experience of, you know, the daily drudgery of an ordinary job.
Oh, well, definitely. I mean, really, I mean, none of these people I had dealt with had ever worked the really lousy jobs and or even above lousy. I mean, I respect and like a lot of these people I work with, but people in the studio system tend to come from really upper-class families. They tend to have gone to good universities and not have had to work at Jack in the Box and Whataburger and just kind of menial, just, you know, office data-crunching type jobs. So yeah, a lot of them, I think, didn't know what it was. You know, then eventually they wanted a sequel, so
so
somebody...
It connected somehow, yeah.
Somebody out there liked it, yeah.
I thought we would hear another scene from Office Space, and this is one of them that I remembered for years. The company, Initech, where everyone works, has brought in a couple of consultants. Both are named Bob, to kind of figure out how to improve things, which is probably going to mean maybe downsizing the workforce. And I thought we'd listen to the scene where they're interviewing this guy played by Richard Reel, who is, I'm not sure what he is, a customer service somebody. Do you remember the scene well enough to kind of to set it up and tell us a little bit about it?
Yeah. What he does there, he's a person who, they used to call it sales engineer, which is actually one of the things my ex-wife did, which is they're the person who goes between the engineer and the customer so that the engineers don't have to deal with, because engineers aren't usually good at dealing with customers. So I sort of based him on a couple people at my first engineering job. There was a guy who had gotten in a little fender bender, and he sued the person in front of him and behind him, and he was always just really nervous. He was always spreading doom and gloom. He was always going around the office saying, yeah, they're going to lay us off. You guys know this, you know? And so I kind of based it on him, and, you know, he's a guy who thinks he has people skills, but that's just relative to engineers who have zero people skills. So
right.
He probably only has some tiny modicum of people skills. And it's kind of sad, actually, as I say it out loud.
He's a funny character, and where he ends up is funny, too. But let's listen to this. He's being interviewed by these two consultants, both named Bob, played by John C. McGinley and Paul Wilson. Let's listen.
What you do in Initech is you take the specifications from the customers and you bring them down to the software engineers.
Yes, that's right.
Well, then I just have to ask, why couldn't the customers just take them directly to the software people, huh?
Well, I'll tell you why. Because engineers are not good at dealing with customers.
Uh-huh. So you physically take the specs from the customer?
Well, no, my secretary does that, or the fax.
Huh. So then you must physically bring them to the software people.
Well, no. Yeah, I mean, sometimes.
What would you say you do here?
Well, look, I already told you. I deal with the damn customers so the engineers don't have to. I have people skills. I am good at dealing with people. Can't you understand that? What the hell is wrong with you people?
That's Richard Reel in the film Office Space with John C. McGinley and Paul Wilson, directed by our guest Mike Judge. It's hard for me to imagine anybody but these three actors doing this scene. And it seems to me that you get a lot of great performances out of relatively little-known actors. I mean, a lot of these people have gone on to bigger careers later. But any particular secret to this? Is it casting, finding exactly what you want in the casting?
Yeah, I kind of drive my casting directors crazy because I guess I'm very particular. And, you know, that movie, I think I drove the studio crazy too because they wanted anybody, pretty much anybody, but who I cast in that movie. Can you just get anybody remotely famous, please? And I thought Jennifer Aniston was great in it. She was the only really famous person in there, so that enabled me to cast the other people that I liked in it.
When people meet you, is there a scene from Office Space that they tend to recite back to you?
Usually it's just a little bit of Lumberg doing the scene you played earlier, yeah. And I was in a Starbucks actually in Austin with Eitan Cohen, who I was writing with at the time, and the people behind the counter started going that, yeah. And Eitan was looking at me like, oh, do they know who you are? And I said, no, I don't think so. And then at some point, the guy goes, oh, have you guys heard of that movie? Have you seen that, Office Space? And then Eitan said, oh, he wrote and directed it, and they didn't believe me.
Well, Mike Judge, it's been fun to have you back. Thanks so much.
All right, thank you.
Mike Judge has created the new HBO series Silicon Valley, which airs Sunday nights at 10. Coming up, Maureen Corrigan reviews two of the most powerful books she's read this year. This is Fresh Air. Two historically based graphic novels have caught our book critic's eye this week. Here's Maureen Corrigan's review of A Bentel Brief and the Harlem Hellfighters.
A Bentel Brief and the Harlem Hellfighters are two New York stories. That's why I'm combining them in this review. Not because, as some purists still think, they're lesser works of literature because they're graphic novels. If Egyptian hieroglyphics, the Bayeux Tapestry, and Art Spiegelman's 1991 classic, Mouse, haven't yet persuaded the high art holdouts of the value of stories told in visual sequence, nothing I say now about these two books is likely to convince them. Which is a shame, because A Bentel Brief by Liana Fink and The Harlem Hellfighters by Max Brooks and illustrated by Kanan White are two of the most powerful books I've read so far this year. A Bentel Brief takes its title from the column of the same name that first appeared in 1906 in the Yiddish-language newspaper The Daily Forward. Literally translated as a bundle of letters, the Bentel Brief was an advice column in which Jewish immigrants new to New York City could ask practical questions as well as give voice to their loneliness, dreams, and fears. The Forward's legendary editor, Abraham Kahn, answered the letters himself, and the column made the Forward the most widely read Yiddish-language newspaper in the world. Author and illustrator Liana Fink places herself in this story as a young woman who opens a notebook of old clippings from the Forward and finds herself confronted with the cranky apparition of Abraham Kahn. Together they walk the streets of the Lower East Side, past abandoned synagogues and pickle factories, talking about the immigrants' letters. Fink has adapted 11 actual letters from the Forward, and they range from the Daffy, a barber obsessed by a nightmare in which he slits the throat of a customer, to the Tormented. I'm thinking especially of the final letter in this collection, written by a desolate young woman whose fiancé has died in the Triangle Shirtwaist factory fire of 1911. Fink's illustrations intensify the emotional resonance of these letters, invoking the buoyant magic of Marc Chagall, but also sometimes descending into the cramped world of the tenements. One page here, for instance, shows a couple despairing over their infertility, sinking and dissolving into their old sofa. Wisely, Fink appreciates that the power of the Bentel Brief stories derives from the fact that they're eternally open-ended. What happened to that mad barber or that young man in Brooklyn who didn't want to bring his father over from the old country, or that baker cursed with a two-timing wife? Kahn gave them his best advice, but we'll never know if they took it. The Harlem Hellfighters begins and ends in New York, but spends years mired in the trenches and battlefields of France. That's because Max Brooks and Kanan White have dramatized the history of the 369th Infantry Regiment during World War I. This African-American regiment, called the Men of Bronze by their French allies and the Harlem Hellfighters by their German enemies, spent 191 days in combat, longer than any other American unit, white or black, and were one of the most decorated units in the entire American Expeditionary Force. They helped make the world safe for democracy, even if, as one Hellfighter in this story ruefully says, democracy wasn't exactly safe back home. As Brooks and White detail in panel after vivid panel, the Hellfighters fought a two-front war against the enemy over there and racial prejudice everywhere, but particularly from their fellow Americans and their own government. The Hellfighters' story stretches from enlistment halls in Harlem to training camps in Spartanburg, South Carolina, where these soldiers were handed broomsticks instead of rifles and were confronted with signs in local shops that read, "No dogs or coloreds." The Hellfighters were deployed to Europe quietly, while the rest of the New York National Guard, the so-called Rainbow Division, were given a grand parade send-off by the city. The Hellfighters were told that black is not a color of the rainbow. This is a stunning work of historical recovery and a very graphic novel. Bodies explode, rats feed on corpses, men are strafed and gassed. It's not pretty, but the in-your-face style of the Harlem Hellfighters is suited to dramatizing a crucial part of American history that hasn't been thrust forcefully enough into our collective faces.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed A Bental Brief and the Harlem Hellfighters. Coming up, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews a collaboration of singer-songwriters Amy Mann and Ted Leo. This is Fresh Air. The Both is the name for the duo formed by veteran singer-songwriters Amy Mann and Ted Leo. The Both is also the name of their debut album. The two began performing together in 2012, when Ted Leo was Mann's opening act. Mann began joining Leo on stage during a set. They liked the sound of their voices together and started collaborating. Rock critic Ken Tucker has this review of The Both.
Trapped in the cold light, dawning on a cold eastern morning. Not shocked, can't be too apart when there were so many warnings. I hear you knock, I hear you unlock my door. I don't want you to have my key anymore. On, but the mailbox is empty when there could have been something.
That's Amy Mann and Ted Leo harmonizing on a song they co-wrote called The Gambler. As separate acts, Ted Leo is generally considered a punk-influenced indie musician for the work he's done with his band The Pharmacists, and Amy Mann as a sensitive singer-songwriter ever since she left the pop star life with the group Till Tuesday in the 1980s. But of course, both of these musicians are more than their genre categories. What their work as The Both suggests is that together, they've found common ground in confidently precise, propulsive melodies, and lyrics that twist with oblique cleverness. That's Milwaukee, one of the first songs Mann and Leo collaborated on in gradually hatching this plan to perform and record together as the Both. They bring out the best in each other musically. Leo gives Mann zip and vigor, she gives him poetry and hard-headedness. Sometimes one of them takes the lead vocal, at other times they trade off lines and harmonize throughout. On a song such as You Can't Help Me Now, they make gloomy sentiments lively.
Anytime you establish a world of your own, you get thrown. Try and answer a bomb with a calm undertone. Alone. I wanted you to know.
In interviews, Amy Mann has said working with Ted Leo has made her feel as though she's in a rock band for the first time, which must make her old bandmates in Till Tuesday feel a tad dismayed. But if anything, the Both includes some of the most Amy Mann-ish of Amy Mann songs, the way her best singing captures an urgent longing and pessimism that's redeemed by a prickly self-awareness.
There's a shadow.
The Both works so well as an album because its songs cohere as the documentation of the ways a new creative partnership revitalizes the familiar habits, tics, tricks, and talents of the collaborators. It sets their individual talents in a new context that compels the listener to form a new appreciation for these musicians. They may begin the album singing about a gamble that didn't pay off, but their own musical collusion really has.
You're gonna make
Rock critic Ken Tucker reviewed The Both, the new album by Amy Mann and Ted Leo from their band, also called The Both. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our associate producer for online media is Molly C.V. Nesper. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. WHYY's chief content officer is Christine Dempsey. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Angie's List, providing reviews of local roofers, painters, landscapers, and plumbers to keep the consumer informed. More at angieslist.com. From Progressive, offering policyholders the option to bundle home and auto insurance coverage. Learn more at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. And from Sit for Life and Herman Miller, featuring the Aeron chair, including the True Black color. Sit for Less is now sitforlife.com. This is NPR.
I'm a little sluttier than the average bear. I really am a little sluttier. I can be honest about that.
Comic Amy Schumer is back for season two of her sketch comedy series Inside Amy Schumer on Comedy Central. And she's currently on tour doing stand-up. Amy Schumer on the next Fresh Air.